this is the first session of New Religious Movements in America. It's October 21st. It's near midnight, October 21st, 1843. And we're all in a barn in a little town in upstate New York, not too far from Vermont. And we have sold all our possessions. We've given everything away to charity that we could. We've told our neighbors goodbye. And we've said goodbye to our family members who are not going to be with us on this great adventure. And we are gathered not in humor, but in intense prayer. And the reason that we're in this barn, and the reason that we're in this barn at this particular time, midnight, October 21st, 1843, is because our leader, William Miller, has told us that Jesus is coming tomorrow. At any moment, there'll be a clap of thunder, the heavens will be rent, the earth will be swallowed up in fire, and Jesus will come on the clouds to claim his own. And we will be part of that small remnant that have heard the call and therefore with joy will hear the trumpet. The trumpet of God sounding to bring God's faithful people to meet Jesus in the air and to go to heaven. You can imagine how excited we are. You can imagine how we feel so bad about the people who are not joining us, the people who laughed at us in that little Baptist church down the road. They'd point that little Baptist church and they'd say, that Miller, they're those Millerites. They're the crazy people, you know. And they said, you know what they're going to do? They're going to climb up on barn roofs. Well, we're not on the roof. We're in here. We're praying. We're not crazy. We don't get up on a roof. That's what our enemies said about us. So we'd be closer to God. We're close to God because we know from the Bible. And we know from our prophet William Miller's testimony and his understanding of the signs of the times. You ever been in an airport where you saw a kiosk and it says signs of the times? Now I'm jumping ahead about 150 years. That's the name of the Adventist publication, Signs of the Time. The Bible is full of them. And it takes a person like Miller to discern the signs of the times that are clearly marked out in the Bible and then to apply them to the life of today. Well, now we drop out of character here and we're back in Holden, here in Holden, in 1993, thinking about new religious movements in America. And as I began to think about this topic in terms of relating it to you, I began to see that it was fairly arbitrary in terms of where we start. I mean, we could start with Native American religion and say that is the bedrock religion of the North American continent. And even that was sort of a new religion. If we assume that the animals don't have a religion, then during some sort of ice age when Columbus was right, he really did find Indians. When Asians came across the ice bridge at the Bering Sea, and began to filter down through, you know, Alaska, Canada, United States, and all the way down into Central and South America, they brought with them their own traditions. And these were the traditions which were flourishing, as we know, on this continent when our friendly conquistadores came to this continent with their own particular religion. So where do you start in terms of talking about new religions in America? I pick 1843 and then 1844, which is even a better date for reasons that will become clear, and some of you know already why that date is so significant. I picked 1843 and 1844 because that relates to the Branch Davidians. So we can have an immediate connection there between upstate New York, the burned over revival district, and Waco, Texas, which is sort of burned over too, isn't it? Unfortunately. So what I propose to do in this hour and the next 4 hours for the three or four of you that'll come back is to talk at you out of my understanding as a teacher of new religious movements in America at the University of Idaho. And also to let you talk. And as I was telling Linda before, 2 years ago when I did a similar discussion or topic, it was a different topic but the same format, I was told, now you've got to have each class be freestanding so that people don't come in on day three and are told, well, as you recall yesterday or the day before. You know, so we're supposed to be kind of self-contained. And I'm going to try to do that and keep faith with that. But the last time I way over prepared, you know, and I was a Nazi pedagogue. And that was shot to smithereens when the first person started to talk. You know. Which was much more valuable than my getting another piece of information across. So I really invite you and encourage you to talk. This is the kind of subject that I find fascinating. And it's of infinite variety, isn't it? How many denominations can you think of? How many Baptists are there, you know? Two seed in the spirit, triumphalist, non-missionary, but friendly Baptist church. You know, and the other 999 Baptist churches. United Methodist, Presbyterian, several brands of Lutheran. How many LDS? How many know what LDS is? Okay, Latter-day Saints, Mormons, right? How many Mormon groups?
At least two.
There are 19 others. There are 22 Mormon groups in this country. Roman Catholics. Big, huh? But woman church within Roman Catholicism and others. Well, you know, we could name 20, 30, 40. J. Gordon Melton, who in addition to his crowning achievement being a friend of mine, is the editor of the Encyclopedia of American Religion, estimates that there are between 1,200 and 1,500 denominations in this country. By denomination, I mean not like Woman Church or not like Lutheran Peace Fellowship or something, which is a derivative or secondary kind of religious organization, but 1,200 to 1,500 primary, distinct religious groups. And my definition of religious group is, has a post office you can send money to. Now, we could have called this cults, couldn't we? We'd have pack them in on cults, right? With demonstrations, maybe? Pardon?
What's a cult?
A cult is group I don't like. This is my straight person here. Thank you very much. Now, isn't that the functional definition of cult? Have you ever heard of somebody that's in a quote cult say, I'm in a cult? Some people say, I'm occult, but not, I'm in a cult, you know? And they don't say, I'm brainwashed. Hello, are you brainwashed? Yes. You know, they don't say that. They say they're in a movement that's transforming my life. They say they're in a movement that's going to transform humanity. But they don't say they're in a cult. What I like to use, the term I like to use is high-intensity religion.
High intensity.
Yeah. Have you ever seen a Lutheran coffee hour? This is low intensity. I mean, this is, we need somebody to cut the lawn next week. This is low intensity. Right? High intensity is we need a squad of people to go to the airport and make $200 by tomorrow. That's high intensity. High intensity is you give me 2 years of your young life and I will give you meaning, I will give you a purpose for your life, and at the end of that, I'll give you a husband or a wife.
Who do you think you are?
I am the Reverend Sun Myung Moon. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I don't like to use the word cult because as an analytical category, it's too broad. It means whatever anybody wants it to mean. You can think about just about any religious group that emerges, and that's another word that I like to use, emerging religions. Any emerging religion is a cult. Like Christianity, for example. Mm-hmm. You know, or Judaism. Yeah.
Wait, what do you imply with religious movement?
That's not too technical for me.
Okay.
How about self-identification? You know, Scientology is a good example. A lot of people don't like Scientology. They say it has cult-like tendencies. You know, people are zombies and they suck all the blood out of your wallet. And it is pretty expensive to be a Scientologist. It's really a franchise operation, you know, for a mind cure kind of thing. Yeah, but it self-identifies as a religion. So, okay, let it be a religion. That gets into the question of what is a religion. And I have a list that I give my students, which I ripped off from my predecessor. You know, 25 or 30 definitions of religion. I think Whitehead said it's what you do with your solitude. It's a way of organizing reality with reference to ultimacy. So let Scientologists be a religion. You know, I'm easy on that. Yeah.
I have a real sharp one about what is religion. It's what you believe.
Okay. Yeah. You know, as my friend said, everybody should have something to believe in. I believe I'll have another beer. So old.
When you speak of this, all these movements, are you? Is it true that they're growing very rapidly today?
No, they're not. They're not. New religious movements in the modern sense started around 1965. 1965 is when the Asian Exclusion Act of 1924 was lifted by Johnson. And so you didn't have a flood. You know, that sounds almost racist, doesn't it? The yellow horde or whatever. But you had a lot of people from Asian countries coming in. And they're bringing their Buddhisms and Hinduisms and Zens and whatnot here and establishing a base. If you look at it in a longer term, look at the 1893. What was happening in 1893? Well, America was beginning to feel about itself the way the British and their with their empire felt about itself in the 1870s. That is very self-confident, very bullish. The markets were good. It looked like the American century was coming. And so there was an exhibition that I don't think any of you attended in 1893 in Chicago, the Columbian Exhibition. And in connection with that, the liberal Protestant ministers of the city of Chicago got together And in the spirit of optimism, in the spirit of, you know, sort of Hegelian progressivism, that Christianity was going to triumph over all the other religions and be spread over the globe like Sherwin-Williams paint. Remember that logo, Cover the Earth? And in their confidence that Christianity, in fact, was the best religion, decided to bring representatives of other religious traditions to Chicago. And as I said, their underlying idea was to show the superiority, the natural superiority of Christianity. But they also had a kind of upfront agenda, which they believed in too, and that is, it's important at this stage in the game, in a kind of global society, and that idea is not new, Holden Village didn't think it up, to have the religions of the world cooperate on world peace and justice kinds of issues rather than work against each other. So here comes, in 1893, Swami Vivekananda. Now, a person before 1893, you know, your average National Geographic reader type person, thought of a Swami as a really weird dude, you know, dressed funny, ate funny foods, spoke in a funny language, and talked about lots of gods rather than the one true God. I mean, this was exotic. Here comes Swami Vivekananda, British educated, three-piece suit, hair under control. And he presents a form of Hinduism called Vedanta, that is the end of the Vedas, or the supreme philosophy in Hinduism, in a very mannered, approachable way. And the people go bananas. They say, this is wonderful stuff. This is an alternative to our usual way of construing reality. And Swami Vivekananda, having wooed the crowds at the Columbian Exposition, stays in the United States and begins to establish Vedanta centers. You've probably seen them in major cities. Look in the phone book. You know, it's always fun to get the thick yellow pages and go under churches. There it is, Vedanta societies. They're still here. But they're small, you know, like you were saying. They're not exponentially growing. Nothing's really growing. I tend to think that the, you know, evangelical growth has a lot to do with recycling the same people. I don't want to put it down, I don't want to minimize it, but put it in perspective. And the decline of the mainline really is not as precipitous as we might think it is. My bottom line here philosophically is I think we're in an axial age. And no matter what subject we take up, the end of modernity, the quote postmodern period, is hitting us all like a ton of bricks. And we're reeling. I mean, just the fact that there are these fundamentalisms, the fact of them is eloquent testimony to the fact that we don't know what the cob is happening. Yeah. So while the new religious phenomenon is not as exciting as it was in the 70s, I mean, let's say 65 to 75, 78, lots of stuff was happening. You know, hippies were hipping, and Moon was doing his anti-communist shtick, and there were the Hare Krishnas were in the airport, and Scientologists were running all over, and you know, it was a nifty time. People were wondering if their kids were going to go off and be with the Maharaji, you know, or go to the Mahesh Yogi, Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, learn to levitate and meditate and, you know, be Eastern and wear funny clothes. It's not so much the case anymore. These groups have settled down several of them have gone through crises of their own in terms of faith or in terms of the perfidy of their leaders. Hare Krishnas are a good example. Some of their top people were discovered in, shall we say, in flagrante delicto, against which they were preaching. And other scandals, you've heard about the one involving Antelope, Oregon, which was changed into Rajneeshpuram by Rajneesh, who is now dead. However, I mean, his movement is pretty dead, like himself, in this country. The government got him. I mean, they were after him, just like they were after Moon, and got him, I think, on false charges. And, you know, that's another thing we can talk about. Do we want the government to be the one to say, this is the good religious movement and this is the bad religious movement? Madison said a long time ago, there ought to be no establishment of religion whatsoever. There shouldn't be chaplains in the military. There shouldn't be chaplains in Congress and the Senate. They shouldn't begin the sessions with prayer. There should be that wall of separation between the civil and the ecclesiastical governments. And he penned this beautiful, eloquent testimony to that view of religious liberty and civil liberty and secularism in a thing called, I love this title, A Memorial and Remonstrance. Isn't that great? Don't you wish you were the author of A Memorial and Remonstrance? Mm-hmm. To the Virginia legislature, arguing there very carefully that it was against the interest both of the church, that is Christianity, and the state, to have a mingling between the two. One of his arguments was, Christianity stands on its own. If it's true, it's going to make its way. This is the Gamaliel idea, right? If it's true, it'll make its way. If it's not true, it'll go down the tubes. By the way, that's a very important kind of dynamic argument within Islam. Maybe we can talk about that over coffee. Islam is one of my favorite religions, and I know more about Islam than I do about the other world religions. So if any of this stuff that I toss off here is interesting to you, you know, let's get together and we'll have a conversation. I'm very eager to do that. I wish we could have more sessions. You know, we only have five. But there's so much to cover and, you know, so much intellectual fun to be had that I'd like to do that outside the framework of the class.
Why is Islam okay. Your favorite?
My favorite things are things that I know a lot about, because my personality is such that the more I know, the better I feel about myself. This is sort of show and tell time, share time, which I never use. And so, you know, the more I know, the better I feel about myself, the more powerful I feel. So I feel more comfortable talking about Islam, because I can do that kind of in my sleep. With Hinduism and Buddhism, Jainism, some of the others, I've taken courses in them, but I have to adhere more to the text. But Islam, you can ask me questions about Islam, Islam, and I can answer them pretty well.
I'm thinking in terms of who and what they call God and their attitudes toward other humans.
Well, I mean, what would you like to know?
Getting rid of people, just shooting them, killing them, because they don't believe the way you do.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you're speaking of the Crusades, right?
Well.
Yeah. Well, it's a touchy subject, very political subject, And, you know, if we could have a session on Islam in the modern world, and that would be, you know, I'd be happy to do that. So if you can get some Islamophiles or Islamophobes, whatever, to organize a little thing, you know, I'd like to do that. Yeah.
I am not that knowledgeable of it. Just a mere cover is all. And then what I see and hear on TV is another influencing thing to make me think what I do.
Yep. Well, many deleterious things have been done in the name of God. This is why Bertrand Russell, this is one of his arguments for not being a Christian. He wrote a book, you know, many decades ago called Why I Am Not a Christian. It was this Scandinavian named Hallaby, isn't that his name? Why I Am a Christian? And Russell's book was Why I Am Not. And one of his most powerful arguments was, I'm not a Christian or I'm not a religious person because on balance, religion has been a deleterious, a bad influence in human history rather than a benign influence. So why should you follow something like this with a track record like that? And he's indicting all the religions, not just Islam. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In other words, you don't think there is a good, if all the religions are not good, where do we stand? We gotta have one that we really believe in. It has to be good, or we wouldn't believe in it.
Well, I agree, and if I may, that takes me back to this idea of the end of modernity, the end of the old assumptions. One of the old assumptions is that Christianity is demonstrably superior to other traditions, and it remains only to advance the cause of an already formed Christianity in the world in order for the world to get better and better. Well, I don't think that's the case. And this room gives me a perfect example to talk about the kind of religious dialogue that I think has to go on, because I don't think we've got it anymore. The thing that you want, and I think you're right. I think we need something like this because we need a paradigm to make sense out of the possibly meaningless universe in which we find ourselves, spinning around on this little planet, you know, and trying to make sense out of things. That, by the way, is why I think that, indulge me here, science and theology are talking about the same thing. You know, you're talking about Christianity and Islam maybe talking about the same thing. I think science in itself and religion in itself, not just Christianity, not just Islam, but any religious system is talking about the same thing. And that thing is reality. The essential question is, I mean, the essential question is not, what is a human, or is there a God, or is there not a God, or am I going to hell, or going to heaven, or is there a hell, is there a heaven? The essential question is, you know, son of a gun, you know, what's up? And science develops its own way of talking about what's up, or what's up.
What's in.
Or what's in, yeah, and so does theology. That's why the science-theology dialogue is a dialogue between cousins. But here's what I think is the way forward. You heard it here first. Three models of doing theology. Model one, here we are sitting around the former fire. This is a great postmodern place, isn't it? There used to be a fire, the fire we can light, Martin Marty talks about. You know? Well, there's not even a fire, they're too light. The fire has gone out, all the wood is gone too. So we're sitting around here confecting Christian theology. And we're all Christians, okay? There's nobody else in the room, we're all Christians. Model two, maybe a more progressive model, Those of us in the inner circle here are the theologians. We are Christian theologians. But, oh my gosh, look at those other people out there. They're sitting around, they're listening in. So as we do Christian theology, we better do it with an awareness that if we go too far astray, they're going to ding us. So they're listening. So if we say, well, of course we know that Jesus is the only way to heaven and all those other people are going to go... maybe we don't want to quite say that. They're listening into our theology. Now the third model is that we push the chairs away and that these people come into the circle also. And that together we develop a theology. Now that doesn't mean that Christianity goes out the window and all its distinctives fade away. Doesn't mean that what we need is a global theology, a theology that takes into account and takes into Christian account not just knowledge about the people out there with their traditions and their understandings of it, reality, but that takes their wisdom into account and puts it together with our wisdom. I like to say, why don't we say that the other religious traditions are onto something? I like that phrase, mainly because I thought of it. But also because it has heuristic interest and use. Why don't we say that the other traditions are onto something? That doesn't mean that we're not onto something and they are, but it also means or suggests that we're onto something, but so are they. So that when Buddhists talk about emptiness, they're not dumb. They're not, you know, they've been talking about emptiness for generations and generations and generations, and there's something about emptiness that has sustained a community of faith and life and ethics that is admirable at points and not admirable at other points. So do we have to pit fullness? Is it where is there a Lutheran church called Fullness of God? Where did I see that? Is that this community? Do we have to pit in an antithetical manner our fullness against Buddhist emptiness? Because what I think we're emerging into is an era of either or rather than both and. Both and is a modern idea that comes from Descartes 400 years ago. Linda, were you going to say something or did somebody?
Oh, I was thinking back earlier when you were mentioning some things, was that I was talking with some people from the United Nations. I had asked them a question about how the World Council of the Churches interacts with the United Nations, and he was saying it's a hands-on, hands-off, all the time kind of strategy that World Council of Churches can help the United Nations in some ways, and some ways they can't because they have to, there is that separation between the two.
Yeah.
And they're sort of like a love-hate relationship all the time. Because I've heard both people from World Council and the United Nations.
Yeah.
How they interact with
right.
Together.
And these are both institutions that are under a great deal, or undergoing a great deal of change.
All the time.
Yeah. And especially now. Mm-hmm. I mean, the UN is picking up a new role in the...
That's what we were listening to last fall, was how the like secondary nations that do not have the power. He was mentioning how the United Nations is like birthing right now, kind of effect in the United Nations
And the World Council likewise is rethinking its identity in a pluralistic world.
I think it's an interesting... Oh, excuse me.
Well, you go first.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I didn't see you.
I think you've hit something that has disturbed me, and I don't know how to explain, and that is, in this world of pluralism, we are, in fact, through this big blender sitting in the middle of us, are we not really losing our identity, our sense of conviction? You know, I feel that on one sense, and then yet it also feels good when we separate all the chairs and bring everybody else in and have a dialogue. I guess my question is, from your perspective, with all the new, quote, religions, unquote, that are, seem to be emerging, or at least I'm becoming aware of, how do we rationalize that? How do you rationalize that? The issue of pluralism versus the issue of maintaining some identity let me just stop right there.
Well, I tend to think that pluralism is permanent. Now, you can say that pluralism is a temporary condition of our understanding at this point. Mm-hmm. But humanity will reach a point at which it will emerge clearly that X is the case and that the others are blind alleys. So clearly, as we are faithful to the Sharia, as we memorize Quran, as we follow the Prophet, and as we imbue our governments with passion for Sharia, Islamic law, gradually the world will become Islamicized and the others will fall by the wayside. Now that's a recognition of pluralism that is temporary, but a pluralism which will be traduced in the future by the mono rather than the multi.
And it will no longer be pluralistic.
It will no longer be pluralistic because there's one essential human nature, there's one destiny for humans, there's one analysis of the human condition, and there's one last ditch effort by Allah to remedy the situation and bring the world into the right way, and that is the Prophet Muhammad. It's clear. There it is. This is what I always tell. Well, I don't tell fundamentalists this. I tell you people about fundamentalists because I don't want to offend them, you know. Well, yeah, I do, but I try not to. You know, if you want an infallible book, be a Muslim, because there you have the mechanical dictation theory writ large, you know. But I, to get back to the topic, see, you get me on Islam and I get all Islamic. You know, what I think is the case, or I'm coming to the conclusion that it's the case, that pluralism is permanent. You look, for example, at subatomic physics, and what little I know of subatomic physics, that field is telling us that there's a kind of intractable pluralism about the way in which we can describe it, or reality, or the world. And that what we're trying to do is create models, if we're really clever, theories first, and then models built based on theories that attempt to give us a language by which we can talk about and describe and maybe gain some measure of power over reality with a capital R. And we do the same thing in religion. We do the same thing in theology. We confect models which enable us to talk about the things of the spirit, but the things of origin and destiny, the things of behavior in this world.
But if pluralism is permanent, that's going to be infinitely more difficult to do, isn't it?
Well, it's difficult, yes, if you, like me, and I suspect like most or all of us, have a not only lingering, but rather deep-seated romantic attachment to the non-plural idea.
Yeah, right.
To the what?
The non-plural idea.
Okay.
I don't know what you want to call it, but the triumphal, or the idea that indeed Islam will triumph, or indeed Hinduism is ultimately the way to go, or secular humanism is the way to go, or Christianity is going to be covering the globe, whatever.
About pluralism.
Okay, she had her hand up.
Oh, well, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Well, it almost seems, and this comes more from teaching, that in the sense that often you have your standard way of presenting something, and people's understanding and ability to learn or to see things is certainly influenced by their cultural context. But as an instructor, you feel like you've got to get everybody there. And so you keep trying a whole bunch of different ways to make sure everybody gets the concept. And in fact, you often end up with that approach that your students take all your different approaches and interpret them differently, and you end up learning a whole bunch back the other way.
Yeah.
But that's what I see as a real strength of the pluralism, in the sense that it gives us a whole bunch of different avenues of trying to get at the same basic truth and to communicate it in ways that we can bridge different cultural understandings or mental views of that.
Yeah, and maybe with the permanent pluralism idea, maybe it's not like the different approaches are different ways of describing the it, but let's entertain the possibility there's no it, and that is what reality is. See, the lines don't converge. Ooh, do we want them to converge? See, because, you know. And I'm not here as Joe Prophet that's going to tell you what's going to happen or where this is going to go. But I think Christian theology is challenged by this bewildering pluralism that people feel very deeply. We were talking kind of, you know, intellectually about it. People feel this very deeply. You know, the kids are different today because they grew up in the Watergate era. You know, so we can kind of step back and say, well, you know, we used to believe in our government and have a deep abiding faith in the American way, blah, blah, blah. But gee, that's difficult. We're cynical now, us older folk. But younger folk don't have that perspective. All they have is the Watergate. They grew up thinking the government was corrupt. And now, you know, that's a symbol or one instance of this sense of modernity being gone. And the old, the lights have gone out. And as John Dominic Crossan says, we're like on little rafts. There are no lights, we're just drifting around. And I think you can see that in movement after movement, and idea after idea, and most strikingly, I think, in fundamentalisms, which are completely freaked by the idea that there is not one overarching, overwhelming paradigm that covers everything from Alpha to Omega. Now, you were going to say something.
You brought us so many things here. I think we need to get back to your option of the discussion group that brings in everybody.
Yeah.
But I know that the pluralism is quite a threat to the Orthodox and to lots of people, and is itself a disturbing and destructive element sometimes because it divides. But it seems to me that while I have struggled a long time that with the fact that the mainline churches have ignored the mass media, haven't had sense enough to use it and get into it, the truth may be both in the discussion method and in recognizing that the progress is made as the mustard seed in the small group, and however tiny this may be. And 10 minutes ago, I was going to respond to what Mark was saying about the UN and the World Council, because what we don't know is that the World Council every 2 years has an interparliamentary conference bringing together confidentially, and I was very privileged to attend one in Germany a good many years ago, and bringing together leaders of the parliaments of the different countries and discussing them theologically and in terms of the issues of the day. And it's a marvelous experience, a day and a half. And it seems to me that this sort of thing needs to go on in comparative religions between the Islam and Christianity and the other religions. You're not gonna do the thing in mass media, but you can you can have a little discussion group, and we can discover our differences and what we have in common without all becoming one of one mind, but seeing what we have in common and how we can grow from this privilege of sharing.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. You've hit on a very important thing. I mean, one of the things that you can do with pluralism is say that we're always going to be at each other's throats, but because we all have different construals of reality. And we have communities that construe reality differently. And therefore, the future of the world is a future of unending warfare. Well, religious people around the world are saying, we have to get beyond that. That's infantile. I mean, I like to talk about fundamentalisms as infantilisms, as Freud did about all religion. And I think he had a problem with religion, obviously, and tended to look at all religion as superstitious and as closing off options to the human mind, you know, as opposing freedom of inquiry. And so, you know, you go back to mother, you go back to father, who has all the answers and who will allow you to get off the responsibility hook. You don't have to be responsible if it's all in a book, or substitute mom or dad for the book. That's why those fundamentalisms, I think, are infantilisms. Yeah.
Yeah, well, I think the conflict between pluralism and what I think we had before was, it was so easy for, if we all shared the same values, it was efficient in that you didn't have to debate a lot of things. One thing could be this way or that way. That's, I think, part of what we are missing, we long for, was that clarity. You know, like you're saying, that, you know, in a way it's getting you off the responsibility hook and so forth. But when you throw in pluralism, what happens is something that I call, you lose the solidity of the average. In other words, the average no longer reflects any one person. Before, when everything was more or less the same, the average was a concept we could all carry in our mind, you know, the average Christian and the values and so forth, and we acted with that. But when we're in a nation like the United States today, what is the average American? It's actually a kind of a statistical mist. And there isn't, we can't understand it, much less act on it. And when you go worldwide, your global theology, that happens big time. I mean, if religion was a democracy, I guess there's more Hindus than anything else or something.
Well, nominal Christians.
Or maybe nominal Christians or whatever. You know, and you start...
A Swede.
Yeah, what is that global theology based on? And then you really have to come down to, well, what is any religious idea based on? What's the authority? And then you don't have any authority. It's like we need to have a world government that isn't, you know, that's separated from religion, and yet it must be based on ideals that somehow span all moral principles.
Yeah.
And you can't get there without the authority, the religious authority, and yet that religious authority is coming from so many different streams. I mean, it's a tremendous problem to face.
Yeah, yeah. Reverend Moon, whom I mentioned earlier, has the solution, although it's a religious solution. And that is that Jesus has appointed him as the Lord of the Second Advent. He comes from the sine qua non spiritual land of the East, Korea, and specifically South Korea. And the future of the world lies in everyone's learning Korean. So there'd be one language, like the old Esperanto. Everybody will speak the same language. And there will be a theocracy under Moon and his successors. That, you see, these now, that's not exactly a fundamentalism, but these kinds of absolutisms, maybe that's a better word, these absolutisms, these comprehensive absolutisms, are medicine for the anxiety of pluralism. People caught in pluralism, unless they work it through and maybe say that science is telling us something, science is on to something, by saying that we're always going to have pluralism because we're never going to get to the TOE, you know, the T-O-E, the theory of everything. Which some people say, well, then we'll know the mind of God. But others say, no, we'll not know the mind of God. We'll just have a lot of stuff figured out, you know, on the human level. But that's not necessarily the mind of God. Please, before you talk, please understand, I like this a lot. And yet I have a little anxiety about truth and advertising, you know. This is supposed to be New Religious Movements in America, and before we break up, I want you to know that my main goal, pedagogical goal, for this session was to help us understand that New Religious Movements in America didn't start in 1965, or they didn't start when you encountered your first saffron-robed Hare Krishna devotee, you know, in the San Francisco airport. It didn't start then. We can go back to 1893 with Swami Vivekananda. That's a real nice starting point, 100 years ago. Huh? Or we can go back to 1844 with Adventism, which was a new way of putting things together. And what I wanted to say, and maybe we can start tomorrow's session with this, 1844 was the second date that Miller had for the end of the world, the coming of Jesus. 1844 is also the date of the martyrdom.
Joseph
Smith. And Smith and Miller both came out of the burned over revival district in upstate New York, which was a fecund place for the production of new religious movements. Mary Baker Eddy, and on and on. So let's say that, well, we've got a couple more official minutes. That's pretty good. Okay. Does somebody who hasn't talked want to talk? Linda.
A question about, you know, another alternative that people seem to be choosing, rather than dealing with pluralism, is to opt out completely and choose individualism. And I'm wondering about trends like, or groups like, and I don't think you can even call it a group, but Marianne Williamson, some of the more, you know, searching for individual meaning, or, you know, I don't know a lot about, you know, I guess New Age, you know, kind of movement and idols or whatever. And I wonder if you'd say something about, you know, that side of what seems to be happening these days in our religious culture, which is people, I think, out of a frustration or fear of trying to deal with the collective, to opting to a much more individually, quote unquote, satisfying choice.
Yeah, if you look at it, you know, sort of historically, you see the medieval synthesis emphasizing the collective. We're all in this together, and each of us has our little, you know, I'm a cobbler and you're a cook and whatnot. And then Luther coming along and putting the emphasis on the self, the isolated self. Now, I mean, jillions of trees have been sacrificed in terms of talking about this particular idea of the introspective consciousness of the conscience of the West. And the focus on the self. And certainly Luther wanted to put the self in the context of church, so that that would be against extreme Western or American individualism. But you do get a movement away from the collective in Catholicism to the self in relation to God, primarily, and not in relation primarily to Pope and authority figures on earth. And then when you take that to the extreme, you get what Robert Bella called Sheilaism. In his et al. Book, Habits of the Heart, you know, he interviews Sheila. And Sheila says, well, you know, I believe in, you know, what else, self-esteem, and I believe in creativity, and I think there's a God, but I don't think about God very much. And, well, I guess you'd call that Sheilaism. You know, it's my cooked up religion. I think there's a lot of that. I think that the grand schemes are, to a lot of people, a thing of the past. You know, grand meaning systems like Judaism that they grew up with, or their Christianity that they grew up with, can't stand up against the pluralism that the postmodern world is showing. For example, if you live in Los Angeles, you could spend 22 consecutive weeks going to the centers of the 22 expressions of Buddhism that are in the Los Angeles basin alone. So, you know, you used to be able to kind of huddle in Luther League or Walter League or MYF and kind of project out from that group, you know, your value system over the whole world. But now that world, because of the physical proximity of all these people, after the Asian Exclusion Act was excluded in 1965, and because of the media, you are in contact with so many other construals of the world. And so people are, this is my, and I think picking up where you're coming from, they're trying to find their little life rafts of meaning, at least to get through in some way. If you take that and put a little more communal flavor on it, you get the 12-step movements. And this thing, as I was thinking about this class, is one of the things that we ought to be looking at as kind of a new religious phenomenon. I mean, there's a 12-step group for every micro condition of the human condition, you know? And it's been praised and damned, and, you know, we're just, I think, in the beginning stages of this 12-step business. So what you might see happening is, you know, First United Methodist Church is the big thing, and, you know, it has a few AA groups, and there's a old Readers Anonymous group, whatnot. We let them use the church. Maybe in 10 years it'll be first Saint 12 step, you know, and fourth and main. And, oh yeah, I think we should let the Methodists have their worship. You know, and this is the therapeutic view of Christianity, that it's a therapy, essentially. Huh? This is Christian Science. This is what's called New Thought, which comes from the turn of the century and comes out of Christian Science. The notion, and if we get to it, we'll do this, the notion that mind is prior to matter. Mind is prior to matter. And that matter really doesn't matter. And if you can change your mind, you can change the matter. That's the essence of New Thought. And if we get to it, we'll talk about what I call art. You get your money's worth by putting something on the board. Art. Art versus Descartes. Oh, I love it. You know, Descartes said, here's the self and here's the objective world, right? And the art, alternative reality tradition, this is the majority reality tradition, mainstream. Alternative reality tradition says that we're all in this together. That it's not mind versus matter, it's mind and matter together. That's, it's not spirit versus matter or flesh, but it's inspirited matter. Everything's connected to everything else. No, says Descartes. Yes, says the alternative reality tradition. So there are jillions of religious groups that fall under this category of alternative reality tradition. Our Lutheran and Methodist and Presbyterian are over here. Well, what's going to happen when there's a conversation between Descartes and Swedenborg? Here's the last thing. John Chapman going around the frontier. Did you know this? John Chapman going around the frontier with his apple seeds. Is planting apples, apple trees, and also distributing Swedenborgian tracts. This is in, what, 1850, 1840. Johnny Appleseed was not only an ecology god, but also a Swedenborgian. And Mary Baker Eddy read Swedenborg, put some of Swedenborg's ideas together into Christian Science. So let's say that that's the end of the official session, and that's kind of a leader for the rest.